Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collection, and I would like to welcome you to another edition of the Michigan Writers Series. Thanks so much for coming out today on such a beautiful winter evening. Another example of global warming, but I'm glad that you're here, and I think we're in for a wonderful evening. We will conduct the evening as we usually do. There'll be a reading for about 45 minutes or so, and then questions and answers afterwards. I'd like to introduce to you tonight our Michigan writer, Margot Legatuta. Margot Legatuta has published four collections of poetry, Embracing the Fall, The Dream Givers, Nodge Lines, and Diversion Road. She is Midwest editor for Plainview Press in Austin, Texas, where she has edited six new anthologies, Variations on the Ordinary, Almost Touching, Wind Dies, Up from the Soles of Our Feet, At the End of Mirror Lake, and Beyond the Lines. A two-time winner of the Midwest Poetry Award and the National Federation of State Poetry Society's Founders Award, she has been nominated by Naomi Shahab Nye for a Pushcart Prize for her work in small press publishing. She publishes a column in Phenomena News and is associate editor for Suburban Lifestyles, where she writes a column, articles, and theater reviews. She teaches writing at U of M Flint and Oakland Community College and hosts a radio program, Art in the Air, on WPON Radio. Her poetry is featured in a 1999 National Literary Anthology, Everywhere is Somewhere Else, and her essays in a new 1999 National Literary Anthology, no, I just said that, and her essays in a new creative nonfiction journal, Peninsula. She is currently working on a new collection of essays, The Heart Before the Course, as well as a new book of poems, Through the Moving Doorway. Please welcome Margot Legatuta.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here, see so many friendly faces and new faces. I come here every year for the Midwest Festival in May, and it's a pleasure to be here in February for a change. I'm going to read kind of an assortment tonight of works from over the years. I'm going to start with a poem that I think is going to be the title poem of the new collection. And I live in Rochester, Michigan, which is about two hours from here. And this was a poem written after an explosion we had right in downtown Rochester a few years ago. It's called Through the Moving Doorway. The day my hometown blew up was Wednesday, an ordinary day on anyone's weekly planner. The boom was heard for 14 miles. There were doors and windows spinning, folks' beds and dishes flying through air all the way to the next town. No one knew this could happen. All the everyday events seemed to stop in mid-air, like the plates and the cups, the little rugs and kitchen magnets, which were now attached to no one's particular kitchen. It was something to see, all right, said the yogurt shop man. We dove for the floor. We thought a plane crashed through our roof. I dropped my chocolate mint swirl and slid right under the lunch counter. Then the sky filled with Mr. Wilson's tax returns, feathers, a few hats, and all the shoes you could imagine. Shoes make a whirring sound as they fly through plate glass windows. Nothing like this ever happens on Main Street, said the chap who makes locks and copies keys. Safe as any suburban setting. I used to count on my town staying put. The boutique on the corner blew right through the bicycle store. It was on the 6 o'clock news. All the camera crews brought sugar donuts while they filmed the prisoners sweeping up the debris. No prisoners ever lived in my hometown, except the ones who were held captive by the walls in their minds. A few trees got away this time and a lamp post. Someone's grandma was in the new phase's beauty shop having her toenails done when the gas main blew up. It shocked the curl right out of her brand new perm. One unlucky fellow died. No one's ever died on Main Street before. What can we count on these days when, just as we've gotten cozy, any one of us could be lifted up and dropped right down in the middle of anywhere else? In the aftermath, I drove around town and saw a little green door on someone's top floor. It was a living room door, and now it opens right up to the sky. That really happened. I was teaching a class the night it happened, and I had a student who was late or absent almost every night, and he had a different excuse each time. And that particular night he came in and said, "I'm sorry I'm late, but downtown Rochester blew up." And I thought that was a likely story till I went home and found out it had. This is a poem called Owning the Fire. A lot of us go to writing conferences in Michigan and around the country. It's a wonderful place to gather and get feedback from other writers. And I was at one of these in Madison, Wisconsin, when the late William Stafford was one of the featured speakers. He was one of, and still is, one of my favorite poets. And we were having such a wonderful meeting and gathering that no one noticed the building was on fire. They had to come and haul us out so the fire team could come in. It wasn't a serious fire. We thought reading poetry was more important than leaving. But the next morning, William Stafford was famous for having a wall where everyone was welcome to put up poems, including him. And the wall was full of fire poems the next morning, of course. And this was mine. It's called Owning the Fire.
Revered.
I thought something had to go together. And since it was about chaos, I could sing it while dropping my kids off at the Burger King. I could bag the first angry housewife, tell her in a flurry of glorious abstractions to uphold the vacuum, that we now have the answer to our lives. Tell her that to understand her life, she needs to number and color code the dust, needs to realize that with her vacuum comes the essence of what drops through the cosmos in a wild flurry. It comes into her very own Eureka bag. I could tell her not to throw away that bag. One look at the serious pattern of life inside the scum she sucks up in a flurry, even the tiniest particle of dust, could solve biology's basic mystery drop by drop. Nonlinear dynamics loves a vacuum. I'd tell her she's the queen of her upright vacuum, pattern born from formlessness, an old bag discovering her youth, with memories dropping like torn movies through the fuzzy boundaries of her life. Tell her the stream of order in that inscrutable dust will come to her in a dark dream, in a flurry while cleaning the breakfast plates, in a flurry of ideas running in the hose of her vacuum. Oh, living, continuous housewife, understand dust, recycle it, carefully filling each bag, challenging the twist on the mystery of life, and savor each existential drop. Order comes from disorder, dust in a paper bag. The flurry dances in your vacuum. We suck life till we drop. That was a lot of fun to work out. And this is the title poem. From the book Embracing the Fall. And I have to tell you, I wrote this poem having not fallen, having never broken a bone, and it was a metaphor. I was actually reading an article in the Chicago Tribune that falling was the cure for fainting, that when you fall down, the blood can rush to your head. So I was using it purely in metaphor, and while the book was in production, I fell and broke my wrist. So the publisher said, "We better be careful what we call your next book." Embracing the Fall. The body, tumbling through space, faces a kind of enigma. Sometimes falling down can clear things up. Limbs flying, an ungraceful arch, it tries to brace itself, defy gravity, prevent the little invasions of iced sidewalk or parquet floor, the slap of indignant boundaries. A faint, a momentary vasovagal dizziness can bring it on, as if the spin of the earth needs to jettison one body in motion, thrown like jetsam from a ship, like unwanted goods bailed out to lighten the overload. Now the fall becomes its own remedy for weakness. Getting lost is a new way to be found. The splat, the horizontal daze, no longer preventable, becomes a lush embrace, a hearty hug of jeweled stimuli to flatten any resistance, bringing the hard head down, down to the level of the heart where blood and dreams can travel over the parched roadmap, the jet stream of resilience, the unbound butterfly in the brain. One more poem I wanted to read from this book was Moving to Muskegon. I was interviewed before I came today here, and we talked about it in the interview. So I thought I would read it. I've actually never been to Muskegon. Poets get to lie. But my son had a dream that he was moving to Muskegon, my youngest son, before he moved out and left me with an empty nest. And he knew the time was coming shortly. And he had a dream that he moved to Muskegon, and we talked about his dream and decided that his fear was about moving away anywhere and leaving me behind. So that became a metaphor for risk, trying something new, and I told him he could move to Muskegon. He didn't move to Muskegon, he moved to Chicago and then LA, but it was the same thing. And so that led me to this poem, Moving to Muskegon. Deciding to move to Muskegon took everything I didn't have, lamps and shovels for digging deep rooms in my heart. Birds of all kinds were wheeling about in pleasure. Muskegon was still the last place I'd have chosen to go. Muskegon seemed like nowhere but an empty hole in the state I call home. Darkness, darkness, and a slow-moving river can cut through white pines of intent. Sometimes a place I've never been just calls up. The sound comes along a wire. Sometimes where I never thought to go, whispers, Montreal, Mozambique, or Helena, Montana. And I have to sit stiller than a dried-up wish to hear an electric, unexpected note, like the hanging and unhanging of bells. I'm going to switch to some poems in an anthology called Wind Eyes that I was pleased to be a part of. We put this book together out in New Mexico, a group of us writers from around the country. This is called Alone in America. Maybe some of you remember when they tore down the Hudson's downtown. This poem was written right before, and I was thinking about Hudson's, losing that downtown Hudson's that I have so many memories of. I am 14 and take the Woodward Avenue bus to shop at downtown Hudson's. I count my money, $156.23. I'm amazed and proud to be all grown up, like a fresh avocado, ripe and ready for anything. I could go anywhere on this 12th of December, 1956, in Cairo or New Guinea, but I'm here on a Detroit bus by myself, a teen with hormones that surge like greyhounds through my radiant veins. The bus driver eyes me like a hungry snake as I pull up my straight khaki skirt to board. I imagine he is James Dean and misunderstood. I want to rebel and drive a Porsche like Jimmy did, but I am now becoming a young lady with white gloves and a veiled pillbox hat. I can buy my parents anything with this pile of money in my alligator bag. Money and wheels, the combination makes me shiver. I'm so proud to be alive and alone in America, and the riots in the streets won't start for years. Speaking of towns, I think I'll read this poem. I haven't read this one in a long time. This is my Elvis poem. Maybe some of you heard. That was actually another theme, wasn't it? I don't know what I would have done without those themes they called and gave us. One year it was Elvis. And I happened to be traveling to Chicago and stopped in Kalamazoo and met an old friend who was writing a newspaper article about the Elvis sightings there. So she gave me some info that got woven into this poem. Looking for Elvis in Kalamazoo. He's been spotted in the Maypole Diner sipping coffee with the regulars. He wears white socks and penny loafers, stonewashed jeans and a button-down. Elvis has gone real on us. He might be anyone now. He's discovered oat bran and thrown away his sequins for a cotton blend. Elvis is hiding in the Burger King, playing chess with someone's grandpa. He doesn't even win sometimes. He wants to be plainer than a fish sandwich. Hordes of women in their 40s prowl the streets with their eyes peeled. They've traced him with divining rods to the front lobby of the Harris Hotel. Hiking up their underalls, they dream of one last look at a star. They watch the lips of the aging bellboys for that famous quiver, that stray curl. They know Elvis can't hide forever under plain wraps in Kalamazoo. Any moment now, he'll slip out and shiver in his ordinary pants. I do write about family quite a bit. It seems the older I get, the more I write about family. I have three grandchildren now. And when my first granddaughter was born, my daughter-in-law came to me with the ultrasound picture. And it was very exciting because when I had my children, there was no way to see them before they were born. So I was quite enthralled, and she wanted me to laminate it. And this is the story of what happened. Ultrasounds. The sound of my granddaughter is soft on shining paper. Metal gray shavings like a face, like eyes. Yes, I see eyes, the sound of eyes coming at me. She lifts arm to forehead with a sound like waving, like a first wave. I think it's her forehead. Isn't that my nose? She is too new riding earthward on a sound in that pink cradle. I remember her father, a curving fetus in my own young womb 30 years ago in Germany. I remember the tickle of his hands long before pictures of sounds of hands were ever possible. I saw him once in a dream. His preformed hands entered my mind on a silver sound 1-3 a.m. when I couldn't sleep. A gift without paper, his eyes moved through night sounds to stare at me, his body still on the other side of being. Laminate, my daughter-in-law says. I want to keep this picture forever. So we put it through, cook it in plastic, and out it comes, all black and indistinct from the heat. Some ultrasounds can't be contained. The heat of too much knowing and holding on burns everything. This is a poem I wrote quite a while ago when the Gulf War started. I was coming back from Ragdale, a writer's colony in Chicago area, and on the radio came the news that we were at war, and it was such a shocking feeling to be all alone in a car in Indiana. It just felt very odd not to have anybody with me and to know that we were at war. And so this is what came from that. Stopping for a bite. In a truck stop diner in Indiana, I hear the news. The Gulf War is now a real war, and I order a grilled chicken sandwich deluxe, hold the mayo, near Gary, Indiana, on my way home to Michigan. I stare at the all-I-can-eat salad bar, fresher than most, with cherry tomatoes and alfalfa sprouts, a tray of unsalted sunflower seeds. Strangely, there are payphones at each table. In case a war breaks out, I think, and I must call my sister in Connecticut. So I do. Hello, Susan, I say. This is the first war I can remember, as clear as endive and a pile of grated cheddar. How are you? I feel afraid. I could be anywhere this tintype night. I could be home watching Ted Koppel explain attacks on TV. I could have a brother on the front or see action myself. But no, this sinking feeling in Indiana, tossed with vinegar and oil, is sprayed with violence, and I am alone with seven truckers trying to decide between the house dressing and the raspberry vinaigrette. I'm going to move to some newer poems. I'd like to read one that, actually won the Midwest Festival Award this year. I have a mother that has lived for a number of years in Gaylord, Michigan, and is currently moving from Gaylord, Michigan. This is called Leaving Gaylord, Michigan. Trees. I like trees. They hold down the dirt and just stand there while I'm too busy to stop. Trees get bare and don't care about it, then explode in their own green time. I'm like that too. When I face the sun straight on, I close down the shoots and stop growing for a while. Then, one April moment in the bark of an old cypress thought, I can't hold it in anymore. Something green and new starts to form behind my eyes. Thinking about spring. This is a poem called Moving Boxes. Kind of a family poem. Sometimes I don't know who I am. I see my image pass by a store window and recognize my Swedish grandmother peering out. She doesn't stop to wave, but I notice her eyes, a certain curve of her chin. Birthdays come and I forget how old I am, till my children remind me with their cards and celebration dinners. I wake up in the morning after a day of moving boxes, and there's a new twinge in my back. My left leg won't bend correctly as I hobble down the stairs. My body says, "Watch what you're doing. You're not who you think you are anymore." I watch my grandchildren play, and I go back 30 years. They are my children, and I must tell them the truth about the world. Time is a circle, I must say. You think you are going forward, but once in a while, everything curves back again. You hear yourself speak in your mother's voice, and you don't want to listen. My grandchildren look at me with their eyes like my father's eyes, and they can't hear what I am saying. They have their own dolls to dress, and it is too late to remind them to wear woolen mittens. Once in a while, a streak of light catches on my glasses, and I'm 16 again. I can't wait to grow up and wear green eyeshadow. My whole life is spread before me like a map, and all I have to do is choose the route, each day a new direction, till it takes me here to this day. It is like a village I drive into, getting stuck in one dead end, then another, till I find a clearing again. In a dream, I am dashing forward to catch a city bus, then recall I've left the baby behind and I forgot to feed her. This is my last baby, and she needs me. She is trotting up a hill, and when she gets to the top, I will be her grandmother. I will wash her hair, fine like my mother's blonde hair, and tell her stories. There will be a story about windows, and how she must look through them, each time, and see her own image eyeing her. She must grow light-winged like a sparrow, and allow herself to fly into the next dream without looking back. But she will never know this until she is older, and she moves too many boxes, and her back hurts like mine. This is a poem that's actually a pretty much an autobiography all in a poem. I didn't go to this workshop, but a friend of mine went to a workshop where they had a trigger idea to write down all the names you've been called in your life and make a poem out of it. And this is what happened. It's called My Name Takes a Boat. My name takes a boat, a Swedish boat, to America when it is only 13. My grandma hangs it on a fence post in Worcester, Massachusetts. Greta, they call her, and then Margaret, as in, look at Margaret run. She runs to serve meatballs to everyone, a round woman with a name that means a pearl. She drops that pearl on me one cloudy September morning after the war, but it doesn't quite fit. Margaret, Elizabeth, Gran. Too long for a short baby, so they call me Margot. So quick, and then it's over, like in ready to go. And I am ready, at the ready, my tired boyfriend likes to say. I bump along with Margot on my necklace for years, all pert and full of wonder. Only folks who still call me Margaret are the teachers, like in Margaret Gran, are you present? And I wonder where I am, feeling less like Margaret every year. Until I dance at my wedding with a short Italian named Steve. Gran falls like a loud suitcase on my foot. I groan and hobble forward, a tense husband on my arm. He's a kind man who calls me Migs when he feels something like love. He learns that from my dad, who must see me as a fighter plane, a force to be reckoned with. Migs is always a way to get what you want from me. But now I am surrounded by all those T's, a multisyllabic sneeze, Lagatuda, that long train tooting as it passes through, that train picking up speed as it moves me forward, sneezing it on my three sons who carry it like hunks of provolone and crusty bread. They call me Mom, that short hum that feels like a hug, like in Mom, come here, I need you. And I stutter over all those T's, carry them still in my wallet, now full of memories and crushed dreams, hold it even after the divorce, after all the angry Lagatudas fold up their tees and leave. I've had it so long now, the tees are comfortable chairs to sit in while I read my mail and clip my toenails. My grandma's name so far away, it seems like a black and white movie. Then here comes Melissa Margaret, grandbaby with a little bird mouth learning to suck. She takes it all in, swallows her teas whole with breast milk, opens her new wide eyes. Two little dark boats from Sweden look up at me when I call out her name. This is a poem I wrote last summer, attending a workshop at Cranbrook. They've had some wonderful poets and writers from across the country teaching workshops. And Mark Doty, who maybe some of you have heard of, who was a teacher of mine in graduate school, who always inspired me very much. I was in his workshop. And he asked us to do the very hard thing, to take something we had already written and go deeper and say the thing we hadn't said yet, which of course made us all quite mad. It was a very emotional workshop, and I got this poem from it, and realized that I had not written for a long time about my divorce, had no intention of ever writing about my divorce again, and thought I had dealt with everything I was going to deal with on that level, and found in that workshop there was one more level to deal with. This is called A Bit of Sweetness. It's been so long now, I almost love him again. That sweet Italian Goomba I lost in the Oakland County Courthouse on Telegraph Road. The grievances were so heavy, my lawyer had to push mine in on a wheeled cart as I sat doing a crossword puzzle I couldn't solve. I said I would write a musical comedy, visioned lawyers dancing a can-can number to the tune of Subpoena the Assets. The only household items he wanted were seven masks from New Guinea, especially the tortoiseshell face with horsehair eyebrows and real teeth. It was so much like his face, I kept it, left it right on the wall to remind me of closure. Its head pulled in so long ago, there wasn't a chance to see eyes. Way down in the bowels of his basement woodshop, that Dracula puppet he carved still remains in an oak coffin. A marriage that shatters won't fit in a box, like my yellowing wedding gown with the pearly trimmed bodice. It's taken me 10 long years to remember laughter on a beach in Cancun when all we wanted was a little time, a little mango punch. Sometimes late at night, a bit of sweetness comes floating up the stairs, his apple pancakes and fresh lingonberry jam. Yesterday, I found a leather-bound dictionary he'd inscribed to Miggs, who will use up all these words. I decide to open it, look up, ambivalence, asset, mask. I think I'm going to move to some poems in an anthology called Everywhere is Someplace Else. And I was delighted to work with 11 writers on this book from all parts of the country. And we created this anthology together. This is a poem that I'm also putting in the introduction to a new anthology called Beyond the Lines, Writing What You Couldn't Say, which is in production right now. And it's about writing the hard things that are difficult to talk about, the things that writing as a discovery helps us learn more about when we put pen to paper and fingers to keyboard. Sometimes we discover new things that we didn't know when we started. And to do that, you have to go into the unknown. You have to write about what you don't know rather than what you do. This is called Up an Unfamiliar Trail. I see tiny hairs on the back of my idea stand up. Wind combs through them as if pushing curtains back. And I see various trees and a sly mountain. The mountain is what I don't know. It stands over me, ominous sometimes, in its silent snow. Has a trail for goats to wander up, a ragged trail full of potholes and a cool dancing river. The river runs right through what I don't know, invites me in for a dip. One toe, another, and a shiver goes up my back. What I don't know is getting deep now, and by nightfall I might be afraid. But still I walk in, knowing I'll never see the full view in this waking world. Ah, but the water. The buoyancy, when I stop resisting the flow. The river in what I don't know holds me up, prepares me for the complicated climb. This is a poem that came from a childhood memory. My father took a lot of home movies, and this is before the days of videos, when we had those old-fashioned movie projectors that went around, and you had to thread the film in them. And my father was quite funny, and he always showed them backwards as well as forwards. And so I have this image of my childhood going backwards. Roll the reel backwards, and it's a home movie in Key Biscayne, Florida. I'm 16, and my ripening body dives into a Ramada Inn pool. I am fruit, and the young man at 7-Eleven picks me. See me waiting for hours at the phone booth. See him never show up for our date. Roll the reel backwards, and he never calls, never catches his eye on my black bathing suit. Water leaps into the air, and the pool spits me, feet first up onto the diving board, and I am dry and moving slowly back, back before his mouth against my mouth, before a word allows itself loose. Roll the reel backwards. Let the word soak up its own connotations, its own cough. Go all the way back, before thought, or even a frame of picture. See the word eat its own desire. Word begins its long, sad journey back, before desire ripens on the tongue. See the picture spliced, a jump cut of light, memory erased. See unsweetened memory dissolve in its own juice. Roll the reel backwards. See the start, a gray flicker, a flower, a blurred hum of light and dust's random dance against a 6, 5, 4, 3, click, 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 click. I'm always in a race against time, and we put together one section of this book. The anthology is arranged a little differently than many anthologies, and the writer's work is spread throughout, and we divided the book into themes. And this is in the time section. Time out. I play with clocks. I like them to fool me a little, like the downstairs dinette clock with the slow afternoon hands that can be counted on to blur a little more time into our teacups when we need it, one lump or two as the day demands. And now it's earlier upstairs. The alarm by the nightstand is daylight savings time. Already the moon wanes a little through my skylight, and I am an hour ahead of myself up here above the living room. I'm on top of things, clicking the days off like wavelengths, and the blue digital noontime keeps flashing on my VCR. I can't find the set button. And so it's high noon again and again, while down on the kitchen stove it's last Monday, a day when everything stopped moving. The roast was done and I was rare and I just didn't have time anymore. The General Electric man came then and he opened that clock to see its own inside world. I could see the gears that wouldn't turn unless I coaxed them with money and American Express. I credit the moon now with helping me understand this found time. On my last trip to Texas, I never changed my watch. I kept subtracting an hour everywhere I went till I was set back days. And that's the days I like, fooling myself that I've got time on my hands, that any afternoon I can still putter away the hours while the big hand keeps spinning and the little hand hides out. This is one of my animal poems. I've got a few animal poems. At a particular spring, the raccoons found my attic, and they really began to multiply. And I had quite a Marriott hotel for raccoons going before they finally caught them all. And I called Animal Control. That's the title of this poem, Animal Control. Every night I hear them building nests in my attic, scratching their way through the drywalls around my room. Brian, the guy from Animal Control, says I tend to imagine things. Says raccoons don't nest this time of year. Says it's probably mice. But oh, at 3 a.m. they rumble. Their digging and clawing begins to enter my dream. The masked animals are driving Harley Davidsons through my brain, and I'm up shouting obscenities at the cat, who seems to like this nightly excitement. It reminds him of the good old days before the divorce, when animal instincts tore this bedroom up, when love could scratch and burn some nights wilder than any raccoon dance. Now the traps are coyly set with marshmallow bait. I've been catching one intruder a week for 7 weeks. Brian says they've never seen anything quite like this at Animal Control. Still, the shifting and clawing won't stop behind the walls. The more loose animals I trap and release, the more frenzied animals come right back in. I finally start to get used to it, while the tiny, forgotten animals inside me take up their shovels and dig. Let's see, just a couple more here. I'm always having my students write childhood experiences, embarrassing experiences. They hate that assignment, but we always get the best writing. This was one of my embarrassing experiences. It's called Drawing Dirty Pictures. I knew it was something really bad. Me and Douglas Paya played one Sunday morning while my parents slept in. He lived five square houses down, five little brick houses, each with its own row of round azalea bushes in front. We hid in my yard, drawing people and their private parts with ballpoint pens on a yellow scratch pad from his father's desk. I was the detail person. I would draw the figure, he would draw the figures, and I would fill in all the fancy parts, like curly hair and red nipples. There was the thrill of outlining and filling in with parts we weren't supposed to mention. There they were, real naked bodies right on paper. He'd scrunch up the sheet and hide it in the bushes, chase me around squealing till we'd both fall, and I'd run back to take a look. Taking a forbidden look at a piece of wrinkled paper in the bushes gave me a rush. Every car that drove by was a threat. I'd duck down in case it was the dirty picture cops. I never wanted to look at Douglas Paya after that. I'd roller skate past his house, my eyes looking straight ahead. I'd pretend not to even know him, that all those lines and curls were never real at all, and none of us had any secret body parts hidden underneath our clothes. Okay, I think I will read just one more poem. I'll read this poem that I wrote for my father, who had a wonderful sense of humor. He didn't live to see this book published, but I knew he would have really been tickled by this poem. My mother is constantly entering the sweepstakes. She still thinks she's going to win, no matter how many lawsuits they have in Michigan. My mother is the big winner. And plus, my father is winning, and my father's been gone for 15 years now. So, you know, she shows me these sweepstakes that my father has won, or almost won. And I had to write this poem. It's called Beat the Deadline or Lose Out. It's official. My deceased father has won the grand sweepstakes again. How he enters them is a mysterious feat from the other side. Open at once, the envelope shouts, reminding him that his response is required post haste, a warning only the deeply buried can appreciate. If he does not claim his cash or the new Pontiac Grand Am that is already his, he will automatically lose everything. Even the dead, it seems, can't escape eligibility for very big prizes. They can be instructed, like the living, to obey the official rules enclosed. This is not a joke or too good to be true, and my missing father's chances of winning are far better than average. Let me explain. No questions will be asked. These are the everybody wins sweepstakes, and death is no excuse for failing to act promptly. Thank you very much.